I know as attorney for Lyndon Johnson that he murdered John Kennedy. He murdered John Kennedy to become president and to avoid prison. And there is no doubt in my mind.
You can't kill the president of the United States unless the next president, the head of the FBI, and the head of the Secret Service are in on the cover-up.
Lyndon called me from the Texas hotel, and he was still irate. I said, Lyndon, about last night, and he went to cursing. He used foul language all the time, and he said, those Kennedys, he repeated, they will never embarrass me again. That's no threat. That's a promise. And I'd like the entire world to know how I personally feel is the fact Lyndon Johnson knew about the assassination and was a part of it.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In the second part, we get stuck in to untangle the lies and ask the questions that don't seem to have occurred to the muzzled mass media journalists. They're refusing to ask them, aren't they? Like the flaccid Fiona Bruce. And she's running her Antiques Roadshow version of Thursday night's BBC Question Time, what used to be a serious political debate show. Not anymore, though, as the editors and producers gag the mouths of professors, doctors and other experts who don't agree with the pharmaceutical industry lobby. And fighting in Nagorno-Karabakh, we look at the week's COVID plandemic developments, including introducing the term Rona scan with single mum Julie Beale, who's been looking into the different types of so-called panacea being cooked up for us, what she calls the Rona vaxes. And she won't call them vaccines because they're nothing like the thing that Edward Jenner invented just down the road here near Sharpness 200 or so years ago. And Richard Madeley says the government response is sheer madness and explains why this week, as well as the mayor of Middlesbrough in open defiance of Boris, saying he refuses to implement these draconian measures in his town. What would our mayor say, I wonder, here in Bristol, Marvin Rees? No prizes for guessing if there were measures brought in here. As well as the Hong Kong virologist that says she has evidence that COVID-19 was definitely man-made at China's Wuhan lab because she worked on it herself. So we'll be concentrating in the second hour on the latest corona scams. So joining me to review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Martin, this week, your thoughts about what do you think some of the developments are in the news, not the corona stuff, everything else?
Well, obviously, we're going to cover Nagorno-Karabakh later on. That's what I was on RT about this week. And that's potentially a very dangerous situation. But I think we're going to cover that later, so I won't cover
that.
What
about here in the UK, though?
Well, obviously, here in the UK, we're sliding towards, Brexit, with, of course, not much attention being paid to it because of all the other things.
What do you make of Ursula von der Leyen this week, then, saying that there's going to be some sort of court case potentially against Britain?
Well, that was always on the cards, wasn't it? I mean, basically, you know, if you signed an agreement and you try and withdraw from it, people are going to take you to court, aren't they? Happens all the time.
Is that, I mean, yeah, but the thing is, surely these things are negotiations that are done between people. As soon as you go to court, really, you're saying, well, we're not going to be negotiating anymore.
Well, the fact is that there's already been an agreement and it's signed and it's basically a legal agreement, like a divorce or anything else. And if you don't agree, you know, if you then try to change it, people are going to take you to court. That's what, I mean, basically, that's what all these things ultimately become, laws, and therefore, you know, legally binding. I mean, that's what it's all about.
Here in Bristol, we've got all sorts going on, lots of high-rise buildings being built still again. But one of the main stories of the week, regionally, locally, is the shutdown of Cheltenham's accident and emergency. I mean, that we're being promised that it's going to open at some point soon. But there's no particular end to this problem in sight. What it's done, as ITV and BBC have been reporting this week, the regional news, is there are massive backlogs of ambulances, like we saw at the very worst of the NHS crisis, queuing up in Gloucester because there is no A&E now in Cheltenham.
Well, I mean, the health service is absolutely fundamental to people's well-being, and of course it's been disastrous, been mismanaged for many decades.
Well, what about the COVID implications here? Because we've been told that the NHS has done a wonderful job, that we've had to clear the decks for these COVID people. The patient levels are now down extremely minimal, and the NHS still can't cope. So surely there's another agenda really here. This is just about cutting the NHS. It's nothing to do with COVID at all.
Well, I mean, the test and trace, instead of being carried out.
Well, we're not talking about test and trace at all here. No, we're talking about whether you can actually get treated in a hospital, accident and emergency centre.
Yeah, but I mean, what I'm pointing out, they could have chosen to use the National Health Service, the mainstream service, to do the test and trace, but instead they gave it to Serco and Deloitte.
It doesn't actually make any difference who they gave it to, does it? Whether you're going to get treated
at A&E
or not.
The point I'm trying to make, Tony, is that they're basically moving towards privatising the health service. And they've been trying to do that for years. And the further development. If there is any trade treaty with the US, they will want access for their pharmaceutical companies to the health service.
So why is it the health service? It seems that to me they're using the COVID crisis as an excuse to shut the health service down.
Well, basically, the Tories have always been. I mean, don't forget that Cameron promised, read my lips, no top-down reorganisation of the health service. And then the Lansley reforms were brought in, which was exactly that, a top-down reorganisation of the health service. And now, of course, they've scrapped all of that, and Public Health England has been handed over to Dido Harding, who's a Tory MP's wife. That is what's going on, and it's in plain sight. They basically are using the COVID crisis, as they used all the other crises, in order to get rid of the principle of a universal service. And that is exactly what Dido Harding's husband, the Tory MP, has actually written about what he wants to do. That's the agenda. It's there in plain sight, like Mein Kampf.
Why is what's going on at Cheltenham happening? They're saying that they're going to try and fix it at some point. We do plan to reopen it. We've got a similar situation that was going on down at Western General Hospital too, Western Supermare, with people having to go, tens of miles away from Western. I'm not even sure where the nearest one, maybe even Bristol, to get treated because they shut that A&E down too.
Well, obviously, it's more expensive if you've got more A&Es distributed across the country. And it's cheaper if you concentrate your efforts in certain parts of the country and not in others. But, of course, that isn't really a universal service, is it?
No, it certainly isn't. Cheltenham General Hospital's Accident and Emergency Department could remain closed until March next year. It was shut temporarily in June this year. And they said, we've got too much to do with the corona. But now they're saying it's not going to open until the middle of next year. I mean, this is surely unacceptable, Martin.
Yes, it is. I mean, in actual fact, we need to spend more on the health service and we need to value it better than we do. But the government, although they talk about, I mean, they haven't, for example, given the health service workers the pay rise, which they clearly deserve after everything they've been doing.
Well, they can't get a pay rise if these people who run the Gloucestershire Trusts here can't actually afford, supposedly, to open this. Anyway, it was aimed, apparently, the closure of Cheltenham Accident and Emergency. We were told at the time, looks now like this was just a tissue of lies, was aimed at reducing the transmission of the virus between patients and to maximum non-COVID care. Well, the fact of the matter is we've now got massive queues in Cheltenham and Gloucester because only one of the A&Es is still open.
Yeah, well, I mean, to be honest with you, I don't know the actual detail of why this particular A&E has been closed, which is why I'm making more general points about the direction.
Well, that's
of policy
why.
Related
I
to
mean,
the
that's
health
what
service.
They've said. I mean, let me just tell you why it's closed. I think it's pretty obvious to anyone with a brain cell, and that is that they've used the COVID as an excuse to shut it. And the actual real reason is that they just don't want to look after people anymore. It's too expensive, or they've decided that actually we'd much rather people were afraid that they might die in the queue trying to get treated, and then they will go and get private health care.
Yeah, I mean, and don't forget that back in the 1970s, there were a hell of a lot more hospital beds than we've got now. And that is as a result of all the reforms over the years, which have basically brought in private sector mentality, which is you actually run everything at maximum capacity with no redundancy in the system. In actual fact, that, of course, then leads when you get to a situation of crisis, you haven't got any spare beds. And, of course, that is deliberately the way they wanted to run it. They wanted to run it more like a private business. Whereas previously, of course, you actually made sure you got loads and loads of beds that you're not always using, but when something comes along, you've got them there when you need them.
I mean, the accusations by people in Cheltenham is that the trust is just twiddling its thumbs, that it's not really intending to any kind of priority to open this, even though many people around. And they had an interview on ITV West this week I watched, where, believe it or not, the head of the trust at Cheltenham Hospital actually stood in front of the camera. Do you know what he was doing?
Twiddling his thumbs.
His thumbs. Round and round and round they were going. So these people are there not to look after us or care for us, but they're there to shut down the National Health Service.
Ultimately, yes. That is the goal of the right wing of the Tory party. As if anybody reads Britannia Unchained, many of the people who wrote that are now in the government. They want to move away from a universal healthcare system. They want either an insurance-based system like in the US. That's what they want. And they've made no secret of it.
And well done to the Cheltenham MP who threw this question right at Boris at Prime Minister's questions this week. Let's see if Boris gave any kind of meaningful answer. What do you think he will, Martin?
I'm not holding my breath, Tony.
Boris Robertson. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Does the Prime Minister believe in the value of local accident and emergency units? And will he work to ensure the return of the A&E to Cheltenham General Hospital? The Local Hospitals Trust has said it will return, but can he try to ensure that it returns sooner rather than later?
Yes, indeed, Mr. Speaker, and I'm assured that the closure to which he refers is only temporary, and I would just remind him that this is the government that is putting in the record, the biggest ever capital investment in the NHS, £34 billion investment in the NHS, to say nothing of the investments we've made just in the last 9 months.
And hopefully can do Chorley at the same time.
Well, I mean, that's the usual boilerplate, isn't it? We've spent more money, but of course the question is, what difference does that make in real terms?
But it's not just Cheltenham, is it? We heard from Leslie Hall, the Speaker of the House there, and hopefully, chipping in himself, hopefully you can do Chorley at the same time, because of course, as the Speaker, even though he's an MP, he can't ask questions, but what he can do is make little quips like that.
Yeah.
Making it quite clear that this isn't just Cheltenham. This sort of problem is right across the country, where accident and emergency centres, the cutting edge, the front line of the National Health Service, particularly when people can't get to see their GPs, having all sorts of trouble getting appointments, the first thing you do is to get to A&E. So what you're basically ending up with is great big queues of sick and dying people desperately trying to get treatment from the doctors, from the NHS.
Yes. I mean, there are the ongoing problems with the way the Tories approach the NHS, and we've got the COVID crisis and all the rest of it on top of that. So, yes, it's not a very happy picture, is it?
Moving to a local story here, well, even more local, that's in Bristol itself. We could now lose everything. A family are told to leave their houseboat in dispute with the council. The family living on a boat in the harbour side in Bristol say they could be made homeless now after being told to leave the vessel by Bristol City Council. This is great, isn't it? I thought they housed people, Bristol City Council, but no, they just like making people homeless. As we heard last week with them trying to turf van dwellers off various places, including the Downs, which is one of the traditional places that people park up when they've got nowhere else to park. Molly Petts and her partner, Trevor Gray, have been living on a boat moored in Wapping Wharf on the harbourside for several years. Back in 2016, they bought a bigger boat in order to start a family. However, the couple's now having a dispute with the councillor over building works carried out to the new boat, which the council said were not approved. The boat, the council said, is also sitting on a harbour under a leisure licence, not a residential licence. But the family claim to have been misled in the process and they're seeking legal advice after being asked to leave by the city council. Now, where do these people, where are they supposed to go, Martin? I know certainly in the planning process, if someone makes alterations to their home in the normal course of events without getting planning permission and they're discovered by the council or the local authorities or reported or grassed up to them, they can mean that part of the house actually being demolished. So I would imagine the council are saying, well, rather than demolish your houseboat, we're going to ask you to leave, or in fact tell you to leave.
Well, you've just made the council's case there. Whether it's reasonable is a matter of opinion, isn't it?
You think it's okay for council to make people homeless?
Well, no, I'm just saying you've made the case that they've modified the houseboat without permission. And if you did it in your house, as you say, you wouldn't be allowed to do it. And of course, the other thing, as the council pointed out, it's a leisure licence, not a living licence.
You seem to be totally disregarding that. I mean, maybe you're one of these New Labour types, like a Blairite type, that actually doesn't see the Labour Party as a party that actually gives a damn about housing people anymore.
Tony, I think the fact is that I don't know enough about this particular case. It sounds hard cheese on them and the council in making its case. The question is, what are the rules here? Have they broken them and all the rest of it? I don't know the case sufficiently
to know. And
do you know
what? Some of the very big posh houses up on the Downs and Clifton and places like that, they will just pay a solicitor to go through the planning permission. The only thing is that if someone has hardly got two pennies to rub together and they're living in a houseboat, then they can just be turfed out and made homeless. I mean, I understood that council's role was to house people, not to go around finding poor people that can't fight back through the courts to kick them out and onto the streets, especially when they've got a family and children.
Yes, I mean, that's a fair point, Tony. And, of course, if they are made homeless and they've got children, then the council is obliged to rehouse them. So you then ask the question, well, what are you going to do to rehouse them? But, of course, there isn't, in fact, enough housing, because for 30 years we haven't actually done anything about social housing, both under New Labour and Tory governments, and that's why we've got a massive homelessness problem, not least because of the rules around universal credit, which everybody's been saying to the government all along, that the five-week, six-week wait for universal credit puts people into rent arrears straight away and then leads them to being evicted. And, of course, this month is when the whole furlough on rent evictions ends. And of course, there's going to be a huge spike in people being made homeless. That's what's going to happen.
When do you think?
Well, I'm in the run-up to Christmas, probably.
Oh, that's nice, isn't it?
Lovely, isn't it?
How cheerful. Wonderful thing to do. Also, questions have been raised this week over social media spying as the council contract is ending with a firm that uses big data software to monitor social media chat. It's due to end today. That's this week. The Bristol City Council's controversial contract to live monitor social and online conversations is ending on the 30th of September, earlier this week. Opposition councillors asked whether authorisation is needed for the surveillance, which they say is covert, until it was revealed earlier this year. The authority hired social media insight analysis company Impact Social to harvest and analyse social media chatter. Well, I post on the mayor's Facebook page quite often, so hopefully they've been monitoring me too. And they've been doing this since March 2018 for the mayor. But this is something that none of the rest of the council had any access to, this information. Only the mayor, Martin, does seem as if this contract is being used actually to help the mayor and to get himself re-elected and to give him political intelligence on what people in the city are thinking about him. But he's not sharing that either with the public or with other councillors, elected councillors.
Well, those are the powers of mayors that the Liberal Democrats and the Tories decided to allow. They can do pretty much what they want. That's the whole point of having elected mayors. I don't agree with them, but there you are.
The council has access at the mayor's office to a live dashboard of all social media data relating to the council. Mr. Rees is receiving monthly reports about what the people in the city are thinking and feeling, largely about him and his policies. One example included a pie chart showing Twitter handles of individuals, such as Lib Dem councillor Tim Kent, who mentioned Marvin Rees, mayor of Bristol, in his tweets. Well, of course, it won't include me on Twitter because Marvin Rees blocked me on Twitter for criticising one of his speeches that he gave. Was the State of the City address a few years ago. And I said I thought it was a rather wooden speech. And for saying that, I was blocked on Twitter. I thought it was just a basic bit of legitimate criticism, as I thought it was a wooden speech. So we've got a very fragile ego of our Mayor Martin.
Well, you may say so, Tony, but I think come May next year, he's very likely to be re-elected, so you'll have plenty of time to complain about it.
Well, we shall see. You think it's likely. I think it's unlikely because of the unpopularity of the mayor.
No, Tony, when people in local elections, don't forget, there's only about 30% of people vote. That will be the core Labour voters will go out and vote for him, because if he's got a red rosette on, they'll vote for him.
Well, I think they're much more likely actually to vote Green, personally. But anyway,
well, they might. The Greens have got some chance.
Green councillor, just on that, Green councillor Clive Stevens has sought answers about whether the council actually needed and gained any authorisation for this surveillance of including other councillors. This is bizarre, isn't it? That one person in the council has got a whole load of intelligence about what all the other councillors are saying about him.
Well, I think you'll find probably at national level that's exactly what Dominic Cummings and others like him are doing all the time. So all that Marvin is doing is copying what is now standard practice by political operatives.
It's also, you know, all over the world. It's not just political operatives, it's corporations, it's big companies that do this sort of thing. Yeah. So this is the sort of thing that you'd expect, you know, some of the big top people at Business West to have advised him to do. That is to say, you know, your big multinationals that reside here in the southwest, people like John Savage, the old he's a right-wing, he was right-wing Labour member. I think he left when Jeremy Corbyn, I don't know if he's rejoined the Labour Party yet, Martin, do you know?
No idea.
So, you know, when he was at Business West, this is the sort of thing he would be advising. What you need is loads of intelligence on your opposition, and of course it's all being paid for out of public money, Martin.
Yeah, but as I say, it's become standard practice all over the world, and it's been exposed here, and that may do some damage to Marvin.
Well, I think
in actual fact, most people won't pick up on it.
Look,
and it's not really going to be a big issue.
It's not standard practice. It's exceptional that Bristol seems to be, anyway, having done a search for this, it seems to be the only major city in the country where money is being spent by the mayor on trying to make sure that he's got all the best intelligence information on his opposition right the way through his term as mayor.
Well, some may say, well, that's Marvin being, proactive and all the rest of it.
Well, might say he's purloining public money for his own personal benefit.
Yes, well, what he's doing is he's trying to get re-elected, Tony, and he's using the powers that he has.
That's fine if he's got donations to do that, but surely he shouldn't be using our money to get re-elected.
Well, no doubt there will be some questions about this. As you can see, that it's been exposed. Some councillors aren't happy about it, and they're going to complain about it, but they can't really do much about it because mayors have full authority under the system created by the Tories and the Lib Dems. Mayors are supposed to be in full charge. They don't have to listen to councillors. They don't have to listen to anybody. They are CEOs of the towns and cities in which they've been elected. It's a stupid system, but there we are.
I went along to a planning appeal the end of last year, to do with some student flats which are being built right next to where I live in St. Paul's. And this particular planning application in Bedminster for massive high-rise buildings which tower over the existing buildings. I mean, this is town planning, Martin, isn't it? Surely the idea is that you don't have a load of ordinary houses, two-storey, maybe 1930s, maybe Victorian houses, with a massive great tower block right next to them. But that's what they've now approved, amazingly, here in Bristol, in Bedminster. So the procedure is the planning committee rejects the application, and what happens then is the developer appeals, and then they win the appeal. They've now been granted planning permission for these massive high-rises, which will be towering over the little houses of Bedminster.
Yes, and of course the Tories are also planning to rip up the planning regulations, weak as they are, so that in actual fact the developers can do exactly what they like, which they pretty much can anyway. As you pointed out, developers can appeal planning decisions, but councils can't if they don't succeed in blocking something. So councils often don't block stuff because they know on appeal they're going to lose, and in actual fact it isn't the council that decides what's built. The developers decide what's built, and the council's rubber stamp.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that quite a good friend to this programme, Councillor Paul Smith, who was the cabinet member for housing, has left his job this week. He's just taken up a job, I think it was on Thursday, at one of the housing associations as chief executive. He's basically walked away, Martin, from the council, saying that this is not, council is not bringing in a Labour housing policy. As I said earlier on, with the people being evicted from their houseboat, at least the council trying to do that, putting people on the streets rather than housing them.
Well, you interviewed Paul Smith on this show a couple of weeks ago. He said he was leaving because he's got a new job doing something else.
But he's walked away. He's walked away from the job.
Walking
he's just
away
left
from the
as
council.
A councillor.
No, what you are trying to do is because of your vendetta against Marvin Rees.
No, Martin, you're
wrong.
What I'm saying is that he walked away from the job because Marvin Rees is not actually doing his job when it comes to housing. Paul cannot do the housing
He didn't agree with you with your the question about the vans, did he? He basically said they're being moved on because it's antisocial behaviour.
Because there's all sorts of stuff going on in this city. It's basically being run like a fiefdom by Marvin Rees, particularly when it comes to housing, with the poorest people in the city, who are supposed to be Labour voters, actually being evicted, booted out. We've seen this in houseboats, we've seen it in van dwellers, and everybody
they're
that's
not
a victim
to
of
vote
the,
a lot of these
everyone
people.
Who's the everyone who's a victim of the Conservative Party is basically being hammered by Marvin Rees, the so-called Labour mayor.
I think that's a very tendentious way to put it.
His job is to house these people.
No, he can't necessarily do it because of the rules and regulations of the central government.
Well, why should he be taking them to court, threatening to evict them?
Because, Tony...
He doesn't have to do that either, does he?
No, he doesn't, but you
Well, why doesn't he just leave them alone?
Well, he doesn't...
Why is he harassing them?
Well, perhaps you... The point of what he made, the point made by Paul Smith was about, particularly in Eastern and other places, there have been complaints of antisocial behaviour.
Yes, but has there been actually any antisocial behaviour?
Well, I'll just tell you.
Or are there vendettas? Have you ever heard of people having vendettas against travellers?
Yes.
Have you ever heard of that?
Right, yes, I
and against gypsies
you.
And yes, things like that.
Yes, but then.
Have you ever heard of that?
No, as Paul Smith pointed out when you interviewed him, travellers has got a specific definition. You have to be a traveller family.
We're people talking who about van dwellers and travellers.
No, but he actually picked you up.
Have you ever heard of
He
have you ever heard of vendettas?
Have you ever heard of vendettas against travellers?
Have you ever heard of that?
Yes,
are you a Labour Party member?
Yes.
I would have thought you had heard of that sort of thing.
Yes, Tony.
Is it okay to approve planning permission for massive tower blocks in Bedminster above all those other houses?
Messing up the entire view
of the city?
Yeah, well, Mayor Ferguson or ex-Mayor Ferguson would agree with what you're saying about that. The problem is the underlying rules are that developers can do pretty much what they like. And the idea that councils can plan, that's all been thrown in the waste paper basket by years and years and years of pro-developer policies pursued by Westminster.
Anyway,
and that's what decides
it. Now Paul Smith has left, and I think it's pretty clear why he's left. I hope listeners will take that from me. That the job of housing in the city is going to be done by three different people. One of them is on the development side as to which lands will be allocated for housing and which won't. Specific developments, the Mayor Marvin Rees will take on that role, as he seems to take on quite a lot of extra roles of people in the cabinet that he doesn't agree with. And also, I think is it Helen Godwin is going to be taking on the community side of it, and the financial side of it, I believe, is going to be Craig Cheney. But the fact of the matter is that housing in the city is going to be changing now Paul Smith's gone. This subject of housing targets also came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister and I were both elected on a manifesto pledge to increase home building and to level up our country. And there is lots to welcome in the planning white paper. But the formula that's being used to allocate the homes seems to be doing the opposite. It's overshot in terms of numbers, and the investment is concreting down rather than levelling up. So could my right honourable friend commit that when the consultation closes tomorrow, that he will pledge to change some of the elements of this, algorithm?
Well, I'm grateful to my right honourable friend. What I can tell her is that we are going to ensure that we have a planning system that is fit for purpose, that allows us to give young people for the first time in a generation the chance of home ownership, which currently millions and millions of people are shut out from. That's what we want to do, but we think we can do it in such a way as to avoid desecrating our beautiful countryside, avoid desecrating our green belt. That is what we're going to do, and I hope very much that she supports it.
Now, this is something that's been bubbling away for years and years, isn't it? This whole idea of, well, where are these houses going to go? Not in my backyard. Almost everybody says that. And Boris is saying, oh, all our beautiful parts of the countryside are all going to be protected. But, of course, they're not.
No, I mean, he's had to row back a bit on this because, of course, in the Tory shires, where basically they're basically resisting having housing built, he's caught between the developers who just want to build what they want to build where they want to build it, and some of his basically core supporters who want to protect their backyards. And of course that's a bit of a struggle for the Tories, you know, because on one hand they've got these voters and on the other hand they've got the developers who actually fund the party. So, but at the same time, I mean, it's quite clear. I mean, all this stuff about home ownership. What we really need is decent homes for people on relatively moderate incomes. And home ownership is basically what they're talking about, really, is helping potential Tory voters to get on the housing ladder so they can get loads of free money at the same time as going on about scrounging.
So you don't agree with the idea of owning your own home?
I don't say that. I'm not against people owning their own
homes.
Well,
that's what you just said.
No, but what you've got to do, Tony, is some people... what used to happen was there was a genuine choice between renting from the council and owning your own home. And for some people on low incomes, it made much more sense to rent than to try and buy, because then you get housing bubbles which crash, and you also get the ridiculous scenario where middle-class people assume that once they're on the housing ladder, they're just going to get free money. That doesn't happen in countries like Germany. Basically, your housing is your housing, and you don't get a capital gain on it. The whole of the tax system since the 1920s in this country has been designed to encourage home ownership at taxpayer expense. So we subsidise this so that people got
tax breaks, didn't they? What that
leads to from an economic point of view is instead of people investing in businesses and making jobs,
they invest in houses. A million miles away from that now in the economy. It's been massively financialised. Yes. I mean, surely, you know, for most people, this is the most important thing that they'll ever buy and own, and you're saying they shouldn't have it.
I'm just saying that the whole thing has been rigged to make sure that middle class people who buy their own homes sold to existing tenants at prices which basically meant you were giving people hundreds of thousands of pounds over a decade or so. Now, not surprisingly, lots of those people voted Tory, but as somebody who doesn't own their own home, and I don't suppose I ever will, I'm paying my taxes so that they can own my home.
This is a sort of
actually belonged to me when I was
This is a beggar thy neighbour attitude.
No, it's not.
I don't want those people who own their own homes to have them.
No, I don't want them to make capital gains on them at my expense.
Well, they don't, do they?
They do. Of course they do.
In what way?
Of course, as you get a property bubble developing, people, without doing any work at all, they gradually get more and more money.
But what about someone that buys their house now? It's likely to fall, isn't it? It's a gamble.
Well, it is a gamble, and of course some people, the people who get in at the last minute, are the ones who are going to lose, and they're the small people, who shouldn't be encouraged to buy their own homes.
There's lots and lots of people who got into negative equity, for example, in the 80s
and
the 90s.
Indeed. And of course...
It is a gamble, isn't it? It's not just a one-way street.
And that's why for people on low incomes, they shouldn't be forced to gamble. Their pensions shouldn't depend upon what their house prices are, because of course what will happen with them is that it will actually be worth less than they've paid for it, and they'll lose money.
Many parts of the world actually do fixed rate mortgages, don't they? So you know exactly what your repayments are going to be. Can't go up and down.
Yeah, well, and also in Singapore, you've got basically the government builds houses and then they sell them to people at a fixed rate, and then they build more houses and they sell them, and it's a state run system. It's not a private free market.
The Rough Sleepers, staying on the issue of housing and homelessness, they came up at Prime Minister's questions again this week.
In January, the government was still pretending there were only 5,000 Rough Sleepers across the whole country. During the lockdown, 15,000 Rough Sleepers were supported under the Everyone In programme. Will the Prime Minister ensure that the homeless charities, councils and others who stepped up and provided accommodation in the crisis are funded for every single person they helped?
Well, he raises a very important point. I think actually it was one of the consolations of this crisis that we were able to prevent so many Rough Sleepers from succumbing in the way that happened, alas, in other countries. I think that was a great effort by communities department and the charities working together. And of course, we will continue to do what we can to support those vital charities to prevent rough sleeping and homelessness.
Well, I mean, the fundamental cause of homelessness, one of the fundamental causes, is Ian Duncan Smith's rules around universal credit. So if you try to claim universal credit, you've got to wait at least 5 weeks, and it was originally 6 weeks, before you get any money, and that money is never paid out. So landlords, private sector landlords, will not rent to people on universal credit. They just won't. And that creates a huge problem, and people who are on universal credit cannot pay, it doesn't pay the rent in many parts of the country, so that's why people either end up, those people end up going to food banks. So that's a massive increase in food banks and homelessness, directly to do with the rules surrounding universal credit. Shelter and all these other charities have been telling the government all along, don't do this, because the housing benefit system used to at least pay from the day that people claimed, so that they could pay their rent and wouldn't end up on the street. The whole purpose of universal credit is to punish the poor by making them homeless. And that's a deliberate political choice by the government.
But he's not committing, is he, to keeping... And one of the most fascinating things about that question was it revealed exactly what we had here in Bristol, which was that the official schools were massively underestimating the number of actual street homeless and rough sleepers. And they are saying there that nationally, the government said before the pandemic that there were 5,000. And it turns out when the pandemic kicked in, there were 15,000 people they had to pay for.
Well, I'm old enough to remember when you very rarely saw people sleeping in the street.
Yeah, me too.
They tended to be middle-aged.
It was early 80s.
They tended to be middle-aged. Yeah, well, one of the things, I remember walking down the Strand in London after the Tories had come to power, and they withdrew all benefits for 16 to 18-year-olds. So kids were coming out of care, and they've obviously been in care because they weren't being looked after by their parents or whoever was supposed to be looking after them, and they're immediately thrown onto the street. So you've got a generation of young people sleeping on the streets.
And of course they're incredibly
getting into drugs.
Well, they're incredibly, I mean, it almost seems like a deliberate policy, doesn't
it? It was a deliberate policy.
To make very young people extremely vulnerable so that they will be prey to, as you say, maybe prostitution, drugs, organised crime, basically.
Yes. And of course, all of it was totally unnecessary. Don't forget, at one stage, the new Labour people were voting with the government to potentially withdraw all benefits for those under the age of 26, because we couldn't afford it, because we bailed the banks out. The injustices are rife, and it's not just because they don't care. They actually go out of their way. They could completely change the universal credit rules and say you're going to get paid from the first day you apply. But they won't do it because it's got to be punitive. And because of that, private sector landlords will not rent to people on universal credit. So that's why it's taken them years to try and roll it out. Everywhere they're trying to roll it out, it massively increases homelessness. And Ian Duncan Smith has got a hell of a lot to answer for.
So when was it that money turned into this punitive, a way of attacking people rather than a way of serving society?
Listen, the welfare system has been basically turned into a punitive system since the Tories came to power in 1979. There was a brief change in attitude, you know, there was some change in attitude during the new Labour years, but this current crop of Tories basically see the benefits system as a means of disciplining poor people. That's how they view it. But of course, there's a fundamental flaw in the system, as I've just pointed out. Private sector landlords will not rent to people on universal credit, and that means they end up in the streets. And that's why they've not been able to roll it out. It was supposed to be rolled out years ago, and they've not been able to do it because every place where they're trying to introduce it, it creates homelessness.
So why is this Labour Council also disciplining poor people? That's a Tory policy.
That's because they haven't got much choices, Tony. It may be at the margin that they should have done certain things differently. I'm always open to criticism, I'm not the mayor. The point is that if they're doing things wrong, then they need to be criticised. But the fundamentals of all of this is to do with the way the Tories have run the country for the last 30 or 40 years.
Yeah, and the way that some Labour mayors, like Marvin Rees, behave exactly as if they are Tories.
I think you would soon notice the difference if we had a Tory mayor of Bristol, Tony. It wouldn't be the same at all.
Well, maybe we should give it a go and find out.
Well, I don't think there's any chance of that whatsoever.
No, neither do I. Also, one of the big criminals in all of this, of course, are the banksters, you know, the one that fragile egos like to look up to, the rich and powerful. And one of the most powerful institutions here in Bristol is Lloyds Bank, based at Castle Park, the so-called business support unit that was used to cripple and crush businesses. I spoke earlier this week to Trevor Mealham. He's part of a group which is victims of Lloyds Bank. And one of those most famous victims was Noel Edmonds. And Lloyds, because Noel Edmonds is well known, famous, and finds it easy to get publicity, they settled out of court with him, and of course not with all these other 100 or so or more other victims. Trevor was also telling me, Martin, that various people were sent into his little group in order to sow discord, to split it, and the idea was to break up the group so that they couldn't operate effectively. This is a psychological warfare technique.
That wouldn't surprise me. I'm not shocked.
So let's have a listen now to Trevor Mealham talking about the business support unit here in Castle Park and what he believes he's found. He's put together something he calls the Matrix, which is about specific individuals at Lloyds Bank and their connections with the authorities via something called Common Purpose.
My name is Trevor Mealham. I'm a victim of criminal fraud by Lloyds Bank. I'm one of hundreds of victims. And so there were 10 BSU units around the UK And typically what happens is you end up at the abattoir, which is Lloyd's BSU Bristol. If you look in the senior police authorities, and Avon Somerset is riddled with it, there's common purpose. If you look at the civil servants above it, there is common purpose. If you look at the Hansards in the House of Commons, there is a bit where fraud was made low priority and it was taken off performance and statistic figures. So, and the bit of that in Hansard actually reads, and it's got the common purpose in it. So there are MPs. I think we'll find the leader of the Reds at the moment is common purpose, and so on. We've had common purpose in government for 3 decades. And when you first look at it, it's hard to get your head round because you think, I'll go and vote. It will make a difference. It doesn't make any difference whatsoever because behind the scenes, you've got this shadow government and it's made up of Reds, Yellows, Blues. And I think what's happening now, we're looking at what Boris is doing. There's been a fight on between Downing Street and Whitehall. And if you look at some of the ones like Sajid Javid, who's from Bristol, and you search him, there's an awful lot of comments there with common purpose. So as a victim, a bank fraud victim, we've been fighting away and going to a lot of these politicians and the regulators. And, you know, you speak to the victims, they say it's like hitting a brick wall, stonewalled. And what research we've done, part of my background was advising on property fraud and money laundering. And I'm what they call an INTJ, so I look at patterns and strategies. And we've been building as a group this big, big matrix with all the victims' evidence we've got. And we're finding that in the regulators, in the FCA, in FOSS, there are people that are clearly common purpose because they're on a lot of the literature. And when you take your complaints there, they will get thrown out. So you've got that. You then go to the police. We know with Avon and Somerset Police, we know that there's victims' evidence that didn't get passed over to Thames Valley Police. So when the police crime commissioner from Avon Somerset set a peer review, which was supposed to be an investigation, you know, if somebody was a murderer and said, you can look anywhere in my car, but you can't look in the glove compartment, you can't look in the boot, you know, you could get a clean bill of health. You could be Peter Sutcliffe. So we've been messed about a lot by the police. And we know that there are connections between seniors at Lloyds Bank and past PMs. One really interesting bit is, if I go back to John Major, his number two was Norman Blackwell. And Norman Blackwell is now the chairman of Lloyds Bank. If we then go, I've got a copy of the matrix here that our group has now got. And if we go to Tony Blair. Now, Tony Blair, he had two very important aides. He had Julia Middleton, who is the front woman, founder, set-up person for Common Purpose. And another one he had was Dr. Wendy Peart. Dr. Wendy Peart is the one that Mr. Azorio, the current CEO of Lloyds, had the affair with. What happened there? Are there some photos or videos about? I don't know. If we then go to Mr. Gordon Brown, his advisor on finance bits was Mr. Budenberg. Robin Budenberg, who started at PwC, who do a lot of Lloyd's audits, and we know that they're wrong. And Mr. Budenberg has been nominated to come back to Lloyd's Bank next year and become its chairman. If we then go down to Mr. Cameron, he actually introduced something from the policy exchange, which is quite a bit of common purpose in there. And that was to reform and bring in police crime commissioners to hold police to account. The police chiefs, they can sack them. The police crime commissioners look after the crime plan. Going to court is a little bit like a pantomime. There's rules and so on. And even if you've got a good solicitor, there will be rules there. However, you know, yeah, if people want to look us up and so on, we've got a website, which is action4justice.co.uk.
So there's Trevor Mealham, actionforjustice.co.uk, raising all sorts of issues, Martin. Really, I mean, we've just been talking about the homeless and the poor, people living in boats, in vans, because they can't afford rent anymore. This is the other end of the spectrum, isn't it? The people who are government advisors on all sorts of massive stipends. They're now being slated to be running these criminal banks, and banks that have basically fleeced their customers and used their basically asset-stripped businesses and sold them off. As soon as they get a loan, they have this thing called bait and switch, which Trevor talks about quite a lot, where you take out a legitimate loan, and then you're told, oh, you've got all sorts of better conditions here if you just sign on the dotted line. And then you find that there's all sorts of other conditions that have changed in the loan that you didn't know about. And then they just press the button and call all the loans in and make a tremendous amount of money at doing this.
Well, I understand that Thames Valley Police were investigating all of this, but that Avon and Somerset did not. And of course, for listeners who are not familiar with it, Common Purpose is an organisation which supposedly trains future leadership talent in the public and private sectors. And so a lot of people, people in positions of authority have been trainees of Common Purpose.
Graduates. So basically, it's a sort of like a Masonic kind of network of specific individuals. One of the things I find so interesting about Common Purpose is when people go on their Common Purpose graduations and they think this is some sort of great thing to get involved in. And for some people, you know, it's like, fine, you know. But what happens is you're talking about many of your childhood experiences and things like this as part of the Common Purpose program. So what happens is, of course, the Common Purpose people, the teachers, the individuals running it, have got a whole load of information about your personal background as well, almost profiling you.
Well, I can imagine that lots of people who get invited to go on Common Purpose courses, and of course they're often paid for by the Common Purpose, and they know that other people who've been on these courses have actually, you know, got into positions of authority, got their careers helped by being part of Common, you know, if you put it on your CV, it looks good when you apply for a job and all the rest of it. You can see why these people, are all, you know, working to a common purpose.
But, okay, so the FCA, the regulators, the Financial Conduct Authority, Common Purpose too, Trevor says.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me, would it? I mean, the whole purpose of Common Purpose
is...
Isn't
it funded by the banking industry? I mean, well, it sounds bizarre.
I'd be very interesting to find out where they were funded from. Yeah, but I mean, what basically we're talking about one of the networks by which ruling classes bind members to themselves. And it's just one of the, I mean, as you say, you mentioned Freemasonry there. That's another mechanism, you know. There's all sorts of mechanisms, isn't there?
The political impact of these banksters has been enormous. Not only the 2008 massive bailouts, nearly £1 trillion bailout in 2008, but we've seen, they're now talking about a $2 trillion bailout in the United States supposedly for the pandemic.
Well, that's right. I mean, if the pandemic hadn't happened, what we would be talking about is the second banking crisis.
Effectively, this is just gifts to the super rich.
Well, it is, of course. What it is the privatisation of profit and the socialisation of losses.
But we can't afford to house people.
No, of course we can't, because but people's needs are very much secondary to the financialization. Basically, what should have happened, if you're following a free market textbook, is in 2008, when the banks went bust, they should have been allowed to go bust, and people who got their money in those banks should have lost it. Because that's what capitalism is all about.
Talking about bust banks, Deutsche Bank money laundering scandal could create the greatest economic crisis in history. This is Mint Press News.
Yeah.
Raul Diego. The leak of the FinCEN files has rocked global markets and augurs a financial crisis of epic proportions as Deutsche Bank hovers over the precipice. Well, we keep hearing about Deutsche Bank hovering over the precipice. It's played a big role in the Second World War too, Deutsche Bank, didn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, they're probably one of the most, probably the most insolvent bank in the world. And of course, what's happened as a result of the pandemic, they've been able to bail. I mean, the stock markets all over the world have been goosed by taxpayer resources. BlackRock have basically taken over financial and economic policy from the elected government in the United States. And of course, this all started in September last year, before the pandemic. And that's why it's very suspicious that the pandemic has come along, because it means that they've been able to basically shovel money down the throat of the banks and just goose the stock market so they can get all these stock market buybacks and all the rest of it, which is a way of basically increasing the remuneration of insiders. And if that had been done without a pandemic, then everybody would have been screaming blue murder, saying, well, you did this 10 years ago, you're doing it again, 12 years ago, you're doing it again, what the hell's going on? But, of course, everybody has accepted that they had to bail the banks out because of the pandemic, and therefore that's extremely suspicious.
Back to Deutsche Bank. Along with several of the world's biggest commercial banks, are embroiled in a global money laundering scandal that spans over two decades, as documents leaked to BuzzFeed show the movement of $2 trillion in illicit cash through the Western banking establishment. The cash of suspicious activity reports, they're called SARS. Funnily enough, nothing to do with the SARS COVID-2, apparently, detailing years of potentially illegal banking transactions, was shared with 108 news organisations in 88 countries, including, according to the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. These records are a requirement for any financial institution that engaged in dollar-denominated transactions anywhere in the world, are filed with the Treasury Department's Intelligence Unit, the Financial Crimes and Enforcement Network, or FinCEN. More than 2,100 SARS released to the press are considered historical documents by the implicated banks, who respond to the usual Pontius Pilate routine. When reached for comment by the media, they wash their hands of the matter, claiming to have fulfilled their legal obligation before the US Treasury, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically, the whole system is control fraud. So even if they're fined, like HSBC were fined for
just to point out, Deutsche Bank is by far the biggest bank in this so-called fraud, in these suspicious activities, money laundering, $2 trillion.
Yeah, but I mean, they're not alone. They're all doing it. HSBC were convicted of money laundering for Los Cetas cartel in Mexico. They were fined. That the bank is fined, which basically means that the individuals who carried out the fraud are not fined. And of course, they just regard being, you know, if the bank is fined and it's only a fraction of the money they've made by doing the illegal activity, it's just basically a cost of doing business. And Philip Green, who was the head of the bank, not only was he not punished, he was made an advisor on tax policy to the Tory government of David Cameron.
Okay, let's move on to the Manchester Arena inquiry, the bomb there in 2017. You sent me this one, Martin, The Guardian, saying that the Manchester Arena bomber was linked to six MI5 subjects of interest. And this is what the inquiry has been hearing.
Yeah, so of course a lot of the relatives are saying, well, they must have, we're not happy with this. They should have known that he was a dangerous guy. There's all sorts of evidence to show that he was, he should have been watched and all the rest.
But there's an enormous amount of intelligence comes into MI5. Surely, I mean, maybe on thousands of people, maybe even on us, you never know. But they can't say that each of them is a terrorist. No, they can't lock everybody up.
I think the fundamental issue here is that the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group has had its headquarters in Manchester since the 1980s. They are the opposition to Gaddafi, and they were implicated in the MI6 plot to assassinate Gaddafi, which led to David Shaler and Annie Machon resigning from MI5.
MI5 have said is that on one occasion, Abadi had himself been made a subject of interest to MI5, but his file was closed 5 months later in July 2014. Now, can we trust MI5 when they say that?
No, we can't. And, of course, his father, who has now turned up in Turkey, he immediately said that this is a stitch up by MI5, because MI5 and MI6 are intimate with the Islamic Fighting Group. They basically used them as a mechanism for fighting Gaddafi, and many of them went to fight in Afghanistan in the 1980s with the full support and knowledge of British intelligence services. So the very least you could say is that the attack in Manchester was blowback for the intelligence services, because they basically allowed these people to operate in Manchester as a safe haven from Libya, and a lot of them were going back to Libya during that period to fight alongside British special forces against the Gaddafi-led Libyan army. So the very least you could say is that because they've had this relationship with these extremists going back to the 80s, that they ought to have known that these people are the sort of people who are going to blow things up. But it may well be, underlying all of this, is that the intelligence services are knowledgeable about Islamic extremism and they want these incidents to take place because it allows them to get more power. It's part of, you know, the 9/11 attack was carried out by the US security forces, and of course the British security forces are intimately linked with them. And their links with Islamist terrorism go back to the 1980s. That's the official story. Officially, we know. We've been working with
18
these groups
times, Martin,
for
apparently
years.
Salman Abedi came to MI5's attention 18 times. And I don't know if one of those times was because I can remember initially when this happened, reporting that someone had told one of the national papers that they had reported him to the anti-terror hotline as well. Phoned in and said, this guy's really iffy and dodgy, keep a close eye on him. And of course they didn't.
No, and it may be that there are various layers to this onion.
Now, was he a lone person doing this on his
own?
Well,
don't forget, somebody knew how to build a proper bomb.
Not him.
No.
But he's supposed to be a lone nutter.
Yeah, well, this is it. But he was definitely Libyan Islamic fighting group because his father was in it, his brother was in it. They were in Libya fighting alongside special forces.
But you see, these people,
Gaddafi.
Martin, this is the key to this, because these people were actually quite hot material, weren't they? Because they knew a tremendous amount about the overthrow of Gaddafi and the British involvement in that.
Well, I think the thing is that don't forget...
The British have been using people like him.
And the 7/7 attacks and all the rest of it. You've got to recognise that Western intelligence services, including MI5 and MI6, have had an intimate relationship with Saudi Arabia and with Libya, where they've encouraged lots of Islamist extremism as part of their general policy to, you know, control the developing world. And of course, at the same time, of course, they want, a lot of so-called Islamist extremism in the West and attacks are essentially orchestrated from inside the intelligence service.
Well, also this week, Manchester Arena bombing inquiry says the fire service apologises for a 2-hour delay responding to the terror attack. Now, it does beg a belief that it's going to take the fire brigade 2 hours to actually get there.
I understand that they thought that maybe somebody with a weapon who was there.
Well, these things are sometimes deliberately, like what happened at the Westminster Bridge attack. Mm. This was circulated as a rumour by the police, but it turned out not to be true, and it meant that nobody went near the area. Everyone went away, including the fire brigade.
Well, I think if we look back to the 7/7 attacks and all of the anomalies there, which were covered in the film Mind the Gap, and also to some extent in
Ludicrous Diversion, I think, is the definitive one on 7/7.
Yeah, but I mean, the point is that most people who've looked into this, the official story is that we worked with the Saudis in the 1980s under Operation Cyclone to take people, the Libyans were very heavily involved in this. They were all taken over to Afghanistan to fight against the Red Army. An Islamic International Brigade was created. They were trained by our own special forces. And then, boo-hoo, they suddenly turned and bit the hand that fed them on 9/11 and thereafter. Now, anybody who believes that story, and that is the mainstream story, then I've got a suspension bridge to tell you. Because, I mean, of course, we've been working exactly the same bunch of extremists against Gaddafi and inside Syria. We're going to come to Nagorno-Karabakh later, but it's quite clear that Syrian mercenaries, effectively, are fighting for the Azeris and being supported by Turkey, which is a part of NATO.
I'll put a link up to this on our show page, because in March 2018... in the Independent, the firefighters did not respond to the bombing for 2 hours because of a false alarm over an active shooter by the police. Lord Kerslake, the former head of the civil service, praised individual acts of bravery, but firefighters stationed nearby heard the blast themselves, prepared for mobilisation, but they were told there was an active shooter, and they meant they did not arrive at the scene for 2 hours. The effect of this was valuable resource was not available. So whoever gave this idea about a fire, an active shooter, was apparently the Strategic Gold Command, and that's the police. So the police kept the firefighters away. Nevertheless, this week, we've read this completely contradictory story where the fire service is apologising for what the police have actually done by scaring them from going in to do anything. In fact, telling them to come nowhere near for 2 hours.
Well, as you pointed out, did this guy act alone? Of course, his brother has now been sentenced, so they're saying that he didn't act alone. But I come back to my fundamental point. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group has had intimate relations with MI6 going back to the 1980s. And they are based in Manchester because MI6 wanted them to be based in Manchester. And that is the policy pursued from the 1980s when Margaret Thatcher was in power and we set up a network of international Islamic extremism all over the world. We created it. Your taxes paid for it.
Okay, and I'll put some links up on our show page to this contradictory story about the Manchester Arena. Of course, when there are massive anomalies like this, Martin, one does have to ask questions. Firefighters, this is from June 2017 even. Firefighters are infuriated after they were stopped from helping bomb victims at Manchester Arena. They've spoken as their shame after being held back by their bosses from helping victims of the arena bomb. No crews were allowed to arrive at the scene until like 90 minutes after the 10:33 p.m. attack.
Yes, I mean, it begs lots of questions, doesn't it? And, of course, most people in the mainstream, if they ask questions, will be asking questions about competence. I think it's more serious than that. There has been, I repeat myself again, there has been an intimate relationship between Western intelligence services like MI6 and Islamist extremism going back decades, and it's not something that ended in Syria. The stuff come out this week through a hack that the British taxpayer was paying massive amounts of money to basically provide propaganda for jihadists in Syria. And we're still working with exactly the same people we were working with back then. And then, of course, we've got this whole idea of, oh, Islamist extremism, we've got to do something about it. Well, one of the things we could do is stop funding it. And, of course, we could stop cooperating with the Saudis, who are the Islamic extremists par excellence.
What is incredible is that no journalists pick up the firefighter's chief on this. And it looks as if the firefighter chief, it was him that actually told his people that he wasn't allowed to go in. Peter O'Reilly's his name, the former chief fire officer at Greater Manchester Fire and Rescue, said he was worried that firefighters would be shot at or hit by a second bombing. So he's apologised, but of course it meant that people died, and the actual real culprits, surely, are the gold commanders from the police that gave out this warning of an active shooter with no evidence whatsoever.
Well, we don't know. I mean, what ought to happen is things ought to be properly investigated. 7-7 ought to be properly investigated because of people saying there were bombs under the trains, the warnings that were given to the Israeli embassy.
Okay, and Manchester Arena,
C4 explosive.
The Manchester Arena attack plotters are still at large, apparently. Now, that's bizarre because we were told that this guy, Salman Abedi, was a lone nutter.
I understand his brother has also been sentenced. But nevertheless, it does beg questions. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, I repeat.
This is Patrick Gibbs, QC, representing the British Transport Police. Don't repeat it.
Yeah.
The public inquiry into the atrocity said it was obvious suicide bomber Salman Abedi and his brother Hashim from South Manchester must have had help. But will the other potential murderers, we don't yet know their names. Could they be working for MI5, those potential helpers?
This is exactly the point I'm trying to make. What needs to be investigated is the linkages between the Islamic Fighting Group of Libya and the Western Intelligence Service, and then perhaps we should be putting some MI6 officers on trial.
So they wanted to get rid of Salman Abedi, the security services, because he knew too much about their operations to overthrow Gaddafi. So do you think he was simply framed for this and maybe, he intentionally blown up himself?
He may have been allowed to carry out the attack. Because don't forget, these attacks are part of a strategy of tension.
He may have been encouraged to do it.
Yes, he may. Or he may have been slipped through the net. Or he may not have done it at all, and he may just be a patsy. Because it's quite possible that a different, as we know on 7-7, a French police officer came out of Scotland Yard and said, what's really worrying about this is it looks as if they use C4 explosive, which is NATO standard issue explosive. And then we were told it was some kind of TATP explosive made out of hair dye. But I think that none of that stacks up. In actual fact, it probably was C4 explosive, as it was in bomb attacks in Italy in the 70s and 80s. In other words, NATO standard issue explosive. How do Islamist extremists get hold of that stuff? And that's because they get it directly from their handlers in the intelligence services, don't they? And if we're going to investigate properly, we wouldn't be sending random Muslim teenagers to prison. We'd be sending some of our top people to prison, like Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who's responsible for the Loyalist terror campaign in Northern Ireland. But, of course, not punished at all. Why would he be punished?
I suppose it's rewarded. Because he's part of the state. The state doesn't generally do very well when it's investigating itself. Well,
that's what Vincent Guerra, the fascist terrorist, said. The state doesn't prosecute the state. I think people have got to wise up to the fact that over many years, the intelligence services, far from protecting us from Islamist extremism, have been the main sponsors of it. And I think what's happened in Syria over the last 10 years really brings that home.
Well, this
it's
is
not as if it's
the
something
heart.
They used to do, they
to,
still do it.
This is getting to the heart of Islamophobia, isn't it? Because we talked last week about Jamal Afghani creating these fake Muslim groups in order to provide a kind of Islam.
The British have been encouraging the more extreme and reactionary elements of Islamic belief and creating structures for many years, because their main enemy from their point of view is actually secular nationalism. So the Muslim Brotherhood was definitely weaponized in Egypt to undermine Nasser.
Well, before we leave the Manchester Arena bombing inquiry, because it's always interesting, isn't it, when these things come out and we look back at the original evidence and it's like that's all been forgotten about and none of the mainstream journalists ask any questions, people like Daniel Sanford, etc., at the BBC just forget that they reported something completely different 2 or 3 years ago. The Manchester Arena bombing inquiry hears a man was fobbed off by security when he warned about a suicide attacker. The man, named only as Witness A, said he approached someone resembling Salman Abedi because he looked out of place. The details of the confrontation emerged at the public inquiry in Manchester. The concert goer said he approached a man resembling Salman Abedi. He looked out of place on the night of the 22nd of May 2017 attack. He said the suspicious man was carrying a large rucksack in the crowded venue. Council said the opening hearing, he said to the man, "What have you got in your rucksack?" He got no reply. He said, "It doesn't look very good, you know. You with a bag in a place like this. What are you doing?" The man is said to have replied, "I'm waiting for somebody, mate. Have you got the time? What time is it?"
Yeah.
He was fobbed off by a security worker, Mohammed Aga, when he warned him about the suspicious man. He said he'd spoken to Mr. Aga at 10:14, some 17 minutes before the detonation. He spoke to Mr. Aga, then said he spoke to his colleague, Kyle Lawler, about the matter 8 minutes before the bomb went off. But neither security control nor anyone else was informed about the suspicious activity, the hearing was told. Now, you know what? This tallies perfectly, doesn't it, with the thing we've reported many times on this programme, Martin, which is a lady called Dawn Waddy, who also went to the security and said here's someone very suspicious who's not interested in the concert, and she's
a woman.
She can't speak. She doesn't speak any English. She's not interested in the in the concert, and she's acting very suspiciously, fiddling with her bag all the way through the concert. Actually, sitting in there, and apparently she was looking and smirking in the direction of where the bomb eventually went off. So the security, at least twice, were warned about Salman Abedi, if indeed he was there, and did absolutely nothing about it. This private security firm.
Well, I mean, there are things that have happened which you could say are, you know, incompetence or failure. But the more sinister thing that people need to get their heads around is that these events are possibly orchestrated. 7-7 almost certainly. And, of course, the purpose of them is a strategy of tension to keep Islamophobia high, to keep spending on military matters high, basically create the groundwork for intervention in places like Syria, which has been reduced to misery by British taxpayers' money.
Well, the Manchester Arena bomb wasn't that, was it? It was an intervention here.
Well, indeed, but the point is that you do it in both places, don't you? I mean, and of course you then say, oh, look at all these extremists in Syria, we're going to have to intervene. But of course they don't say, well, in actual fact, the extremists in Syria were orchestrated by NATO and the Gulf states. And they were paid and trained, by resources paid by British taxpayers. That's the truth. And people just, the mainstream media basically don't bother to investigate these things. And they don't have a framework that allows them to understand what's going on. You know, they don't know anything about the history of NATO intelligence services. They just presume it's all James Bond and they're the good guys.
Yes, unfortunately they're not, are they? Anyway, so let's go back to PMQs, a final visit for a little while anyway. There is a trade, and you can say something about this before we hear this, Martin, because, you know, obviously there's this trade battle going on with the EU, but it's also going on with the US, isn't it?
Well, I mean, there's all sorts of things in the kaleidoscope at the moment, aren't there? I mean, we've done a trade deal with Japan. That trade deal with Japan actually puts limits on the state aid that British companies can receive. So at the same time, we're trying to argue with the EU that we want to, because this is Cummings' particular little project, that we want to be able to, break EU state aid rules, even though we've already agreed that we're not going to use state aid in the agreement with Japan. I mean, it's quite bizarre, really, because the EU, other countries in the EU actually are more inclined to support their industries with state aid, and Britain has always argued against it, because we're a free market, buccaneering country, we don't believe in state aid. But Cummings particularly wants a slush fund of state aid so he can hand it out to his mates in the artificial intelligence industry. And he thinks that this is, and that's the one of the sticking points. And the obvious
thing.
So
why do we hear no criticism of this sort of thing from Keir Starmer?
Keir Starmer, because he was a Remainer, and because he called for a second referendum, and he's trying to win back the Red Wall, which largely voted for Brexit, he's trying to just stay out of it and let them, basically let the Tories have enough rope to hang themselves. Because it's
quite
right.
Well, that is a tactic, but is it a winning tactic?
Well, I think that's what he's decided to do. I mean, to be honest with you, see, if he was to criticise what's going on, they haven't got the numbers in the House of Commons to vote down what the government's doing, unlike last year. So there's they can do what they want. So they might as well let them do what they want, and then people will find out when they've done what they want whether they like it or not.
Well, your strategy of going for a second referendum was was a complete failure.
It didn't work in the circumstances. It was perfectly legitimate for people to call for one if they wanted one.
But it lost you the election. It lost Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, that's one of the things.
And now you've got Keir Starmer from the Trilateral Commission.
Keir Starmer is, people might argue with him, but I mean, in some respects, he's done a reasonable job of holding the government to account.
He's not held them to account at all. Well, he actually agrees with what they're doing.
Well, they've lost 21 points from opinion polls. They were riding high at the beginning of the crisis.
Well, that's largely Boris, isn't it?
Well, that's right.
Let's have a listen now to this bit about the trade war with the States, because this, I think, is one of the fascinating sides of this. Many people who voted for Brexit thought everything was going to go swimmingly, and we were going to have a lovely trade relationship with the States.
David Mundell!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Does my right honourable friend agree with me that it's essential that the iniquitous tariffs that the US has placed on Scotch malt whiskey be removed during the current presidential term? And therefore, will he commit the government, as a matter of urgency, to reach a bilateral agreement with the US on the Airbus-Boeing dispute so that that can happen?
Yeah. Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to my right honourable friend for raising this important matter. I've raised several times myself with President Trump and others in the US administration. We will continue to take a very robust line, and it cannot be right that American consumers should continue to pay over the odds for Scotch. It cannot be right that this discrimination should continue, and we will fight it every step of the way.
So there you have it. All sorts of problems with the relationship with the US, Martin. It doesn't seem as if it's going to be an easy ride at all, does it?
No, it never was going to be. Trade deals are incredibly contentious, which is why it's so hard to negotiate them.
Trump was a big friend of Nigel Farage, apparently, but now he's turned the tables on us.
Well, don't forget that Trump never promised that he was going to make Britain great again, did he? And his attitude is, I'm going to do everything I can to help my own people.
Yeah, he wants to bring us
money
to heel, doesn't he?
Well, that's right. And that we will be in a very weak position in negotiating with him. Although what may happen is a result of this withdrawal from the withdrawal agreement that was signed with the EU, is that the Congress in the US will not ratify any trade agreement which they think imperils the Good Friday Agreement. So, in other words, there's no deal to be done there. And there's probably no deal to be done with the EU either. So, and the WTO is about to be smashed by Trump because he's not interested in having, because the Chinese, basically all the Trump tariffs on Chinese goods, the World Trade Organization has said, well, they're not fair. And that basically the Chinese are in the right. So Trump's answer to that is just to say, well, sod the World Trade Organization. So it could well be, come January, that we'll be leaving the EU, we'll have no deals with the US, and the World Trade Organization won't have a disputes panel. So in other words, we'll be trading completely without any kind of rules at all, and it's going to be extremely messy.
Okay, let's look at the end of the Julian Assange hearing. I call it the extraordinary extradition hearing, just as a sort of reference to extraordinary rendition, because it seems like it's the same kind of people that were brewing up torture in secret prisons that are running this trial. Well, it seems like a trial, even though it's only a hearing, Martin.
Yes, I mean, it's basically a travesty. You know, it's a kangaroo court for an Australian who's not an American citizen.
It's obviously not just us saying that. Obviously, we're very concerned about press freedom. The thing is that, I'm not going to say it. Let's let the Niels Meltzer, the special rapporteur on torture for the United Nations, and he gave a comment yesterday about the Julian Assange trial.
This really is a battle over press freedom, over the rule of law, over the future, I would say even of democracy, because democracy, which means that the people control governmental power, this cannot exist with secrecy. Yeah, you deprive the public of their right to know, and you deprive them of the tools to control the government.
So that's Niels Meltzer, UN Special Rapporteur on Torture. He's saying this is just the end of the rule of law in Britain, basically, the end of democracy if Assange is extradited. If Judge Barrister rules in the US favour, that's it. You might as well tear up any kind of rights of democracy, and the rule of law is completely gone.
Yeah, I cannot see any basis in English common law for Assange to be held. It's complete defiance of habeas corpus. And this is basically a travesty, and of course,
They're holding him because they believe he will run away if they let him go. So you know they need to have to have him at this hearing, Martin. And if they just let him go and walk around and say, well, we're going to give you bail, that he'll abscond.
Well, it's not a question just of bail. The charges are absurd. And they keep changing the charges as well. That's one of the things they've done. So the defence has been based on one set of charges, and then suddenly they said, oh, no, we're going to charge you with all these other things. In other words, they're basically making it up as they go along, which you're not supposed to do. And most of the media have ignored this and treated it as if it's, you know, a joke. And of course, particularly The Guardian covered themselves in ignominy here, because they were the ones who leaked the passwords which allowed the WikiLeaks files to be accessed.
And there's been a lot of criticism, particularly by Media Lens this week, of the BBC, who say that they've had a reporter in there all the way through the hearing, I suppose listening by some sort of a video link. Mm. But they've hardly reported on the case at all on the BBC. It's almost as if it has never happened, even though it's probably one of the most important cases in the world right now, in history in the UK.
Yeah, and of course, what may happen, and I hope it does happen, is that he walks free and then he's going to be demanding massive damages. But of course, we shall have to see. I mean, basically, there's no basis here, as far as I can see, for any prosecution in a court of law in England. And, he ought to walk free right now. I mean, there shouldn't be any doubt about it.
What's going on with the BBC? Why haven't they been reporting this?
Well, don't forget, the BBC is about to be put under the cosh by Charles Moore and others, who used to run the Telegraph.
Well, he was quite a good editor of the Telegraph in his day.
Yeah, well, okay, but I mean, the point is the BBC don't want to be reporting on Assange any more than the Telegraph reports on Assange.
Well, it might be.
Because that's where we're going, isn't it?
It might be that you might see some changes at the BBC. Depends who actually becomes the chairman. But anyway, so we've got almost like a BBC mind control channel where they're telling us what the establishment wants us to hear rather than what we need to
hear.
Everything that Russia do is wrong. The BBC never noticed when Israel bombed Syria. They haven't noticed that more people were killed by the lockdown than saved by it. They haven't noticed that Belarus, who didn't lock down and used chloroquine, have a seven times lower death rate than the UK. They haven't noticed that we need all young people to catch the virus if we want herd immunity, because not one young person has died of COVID. They haven't noticed that COVID is probably a bioweapon, and they haven't noticed that asymptomatic cases are not the same as deaths. So they really are, I mean, they're basically like gaslighting the entire population of the BBC right now. And I would say this is national BBC, not the regional or local BBC.
Well, I agree that the BBC has, in terms of reporting on things like the Assange case and others, have been basically lapdogs for the establishment. But I don't necessarily agree with all the other things that were in that list. The BBC.
Andrew Neil has left in a huff. I mean, well, no, he's, you know, he's been booted out basically, and he's gone on to start his own channel, rather like Prince Charles. It seems like that's the fad. Mm. Also, Martin, I noticed this week that the Queen, and you pointed this out to me last Friday, the Queen after the show is to get a bailout from the taxpayer after her land and property investments plummeted due to the coronavirus pandemic. Well, why is it that all these people that are being thrown on the streets, made homeless, etc., by having their livelihoods destroyed by the government coronavirus rules, they are not, but the Queen is going to get a bailout, a 25% share of the profits of the Crown estate, apparently, from us, the taxpayer.
Well, there you go. One law for us and one law for them.
So £350,000 may be just the level of inflation. The monarch will get an increase of 0.4% in her grant because of all the difficulties she's had with coping with the poor old coronavirus, to up to £86.3 million of public money. Now, surely she's got a massive land holdings, as has Charles. She doesn't need any money at all from the public purse, does she?
Well, the argument is that if they're going to be part of the constitution, they have to be paid to do that bit. I would argue, in fact, that their vast wealth belongs to the state. The Duchy of Lancaster is part of the state, but of course it's treated as private money, which then can be spent on anything they want. I think that's ultimately what may happen, may have to happen, is their whole estate has to fall to the state and be used for purposes.
So back to Assange, why is it going to be taken till the 4th of January next year for us to hear a verdict? This just sounds to me like the whole thing is being fitted up, cooked up. I mean, surely if the judge, barrister, was being an honest person, then she could just give a verdict next week. She could give her judgment next week. But no, we've got to wait all the way through October, November, December. 3 months she's got, a quarter of a year, a whole season, in order to cook up some sort of response, which is, I would imagine, be actually probably written for her by the United States. This isn't justice.
No, it isn't. And of course, they're putting it off because they can't quite come up with anything which is credible. And that's why one of the things they've had to change the charges, because they basically can't, the charges that they started with, they can't sustain them. So they're trying to find something else. Basically, it's a kangaroo court. That's what it is.
So like many people who are in lockdown and obeying the rules, Julian Assange is going to have to spend Christmas behind bars.
Well, he's already spent years in solitary confinement, effectively. And of course, the other thing that's happening is the Spanish judges are looking into the role of the,
I mean, how is it
private
possible?
Company in Ecuadorian embassy.
That's what I'm coming on to. How is it possible for this extradition be allowed when it's been proved and shown in court that the Americans, and the Ecuadorian embassy were spying on all the conversations going on between Julian Assange and his lawyer? Obviously, that's, you know, they have basically broken all the legal protocols, and so this should be thrown out immediately. I mean, he should have walked out today. Yesterday.
They were also talking about the possibility of poisoning him. And in fact, the trail there leads back to Sheldon Adelson's, if you know who he is, the biggest contributor to Republican funds in the US, owner of casinos, fanatical pro-Zionist. His security people, who are related to the CIA, were the people who were talking to the private security company, which is now being prosecuted in Spain, for breaking the law. And they've now called for this guy who was the head of Adelson Security to be extradited to Spain to stand trial. And of course the US is attempting to avoid having him extradited. This is a massive can of worms. The CIA and British intelligence services have been involved in law-breaking here. And they should be prosecuted, shouldn't they? Not Assange.
So I think we'll finish the first part of the programme this week, Martin, by hearing from Julian Assange's fiancée, Stella Morris, who gave a statement yesterday outside the Old Bailey. Bit of a tearjerker.
It's a fight for Julian's life. A fight for press freedom. And a fight for the truth. Over the past 4 weeks, the true nature of this prosecution has come to light. Julian is being punished for performing a public service that we have all benefited from. He is in prison because he informed you of actual crimes and atrocities being committed by a foreign power. That foreign power has ripped away his freedom and has torn our family apart. That power wants to put him in incommunicado detention in the deepest, darkest hole of its prison system for the rest of his life. Julian faces a 175-year prison sentence. Most of the charges relate to simply receiving and possessing government documents. Under oath, the prosecution concedes that it has no evidence that a single person has ever come to physical harm because of these publications. Julian is not a U.S. citizen. He has never lived there. He did not sign an oath to the U.S. government. He should not be sent there. Julian's duty is to the public, to publish evidence of wrongdoing, and that's what he did. Terrible crimes were committed in Iraq and Afghanistan, and terrible crimes were committed at Guantanamo Bay. The perpetrators of those crimes, they're not in prison, but Julian is. Julian is a publisher. Julian is also a son. He's a friend. He's my fiancé and a father. Our children need their father. Julian needs his freedom. And our democracy needs a free press. Thank you.
Well, that's the voice of Stella Morris, Julian Assange's fiancé, Martin. Now, this has been compared to the Dreyfus case, something that happened in the late 1800s in France. Can you... late 1900s in France. Could you take us through the comparison? Why should we compare this to Dreyfus?
Well, the Dreyfus case became a kind of one of the first cause célèbre.
Hasn't Roland Polanski just brought a film out?
Yes, that's right.
I was very much wanting to see that. I seem to remember the beginning of this year, and I couldn't manage to get to see it. I think it was called Jacques Hughes.
Yeah, well, Jacques Hughes was what Victor Hugo, who was defended. Dreyfus was falsely accused of selling secrets to the Germans because he was Jewish.
So this was a famous bit of anti-Semitism by the French authorities.
Yeah, that's right.
Wasn't he an artillery officer that was fitted up? And they said that you've been passing this information to the Germans, but actually he hadn't at all. And it was the whole idea was to basically besmirch and smear Jews who were army officers in the French army to make everybody suspicious of Jews. And the whole thing was a setup from the word go. And he was sent to Devil's Island.
He was, yeah. And it became a touchstone of whether you were a progressive or a reactionary in French politics. So ultimately he was vindicated and released as a result of the campaigns. Victor Hugo, who wrote Les Miserables, he was a journalist and he campaigned on behalf of Dreyfus. Obviously there's differences between Assange's case and the Dreyfus case, but it's got the same political importance. If Assange is extradited from Britain, basically that's overturning the British legal system, because he's not committed any crime in English law, none whatsoever. And how can you can't be extradited to a foreign country for committing crimes which aren't a crime in English law. And but essentially the US are using courts around the world to enforce their own version of the truth in defiance of law. So one of the other things they're doing is they're prosecuting and harassing the people at the International Criminal Court, because they want to investigate some US actions in Afghanistan and some Israeli actions in Palestine. And of course, the US isn't signed up to the International Criminal Court, just as it isn't signed up to the Chemical Weapons and Biological Weapons Conventions, even though it demands that everybody else fulfills the criteria. They don't and they won't. And of course, they're not signed up to the Law of the Sea either. So they've got no right to intervene in the South China Sea at all, because they basically haven't signed any agreements which would affect their own territorial waters. So and they're basically lawless. And what's happening is that the British state is being dragged into rubber stamping the lawlessness of the US government.
Okay, so the book is originally, it's based on, it's called An Officer and a Spy. Roman Polanski's film, which came out last year, is called J'accuse. I was looking for it around about January, February time, before I went off to New Zealand, Martin. I couldn't find it on anywhere around the Bristol area. And I was looking pretty closely, and certainly the people I was speaking to at the various cinemas were saying, well, we're hoping to have it soon. It does seem this has been suppressed, this film, and maybe we're finding why by making comparisons with Julian Assange. But some will say, look, this is the anti-Semitism is not involved in the Assange case, and it's actually, you're trying to egg it up a bit by saying that it's comparable to Dreyfus. So can you just anywhere near as important?
The two cases are quite different in some respects, but the important, the Dreyfus case in France became a touchstone of whether you were progressive or reactionary. And I think it's pretty clear those who have come out in support of Assange are the genuine progressive voices in this country. And those who haven't, and who still continue to undermine his position, and basically, I mean, and there's plenty of them, they are basically shameless. I mean, people like Luke Harding at The Guardian, who work closely with Assange on getting these WikiLeaks stuff out there, and have now turned on him and claimed that he's a fantasist, he's this, he's that, and they want him extradited. They have made their careers on the back of Julian Assange's investigative journalism. And of course, Luke Harding is one of the great Putin haters, and basically he's got loads of chums in MI6, the friends of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group.
I've never seen J'accuse. Oh, I'm really looking forward to seeing it. I remember actually watching the film about Catherine Gunn also earlier this year, which was absolutely blindingly brilliant, but of course no reviews at all, hardly any positive reviews, all loads of negative reviews, etc. It does seem as if we've got a media which hates the truth and does everything it does to turn the world upside down.